Thank you. So yeah, I'm talking about work, which I don't know if this is.
The microphone doesn't amplify for recording.
I see. Okay. I'm talking about this work, which has not yet appeared, but I actually posted it to the archive today, so it will be appearing tomorrow. And so it's a long title, but we will unpack that as we go. And so I did it with Wenwei Ho and Philip Dimitrescu. So first part of my title, phases of matter. Well, we probably know what phases of matter are. They're, you know, emergent phenomena in quantum many-body systems, which become sharply distinct in the thermodynamic limit. So in the thermodynamic limit, a liquid is different from a ferromagnet, and they have to be separated by a phase transition, and so on. And of course, the symmetry plays a very important role in understanding phases of matter, because we know, for example, that we can have phases that are characterized by the order parameter is the spontaneous symmetry breaking. So crystal spontaneously breaks spatial symmetries, for example. And then we also more recently know that symmetry is also important for understanding phases which are not spontaneously symmetry breaking. So we have this idea of topological phases, which are distinguished by patterns of quantum entanglement. But symmetry turns out to be very important in these phases too. There's this idea of symmetry-protected topological phases, symmetry-enriched topological phases. These are phases, topological phases, but they're also characterized by the presence of a symmetry. For example, topological insulators are non-trivial phases in the presence of time reversal symmetry, even though time reversal symmetry is not spontaneously broken, it's preserved. The point of my talk today, I'm going to talk about non-equilibrium phases of matter. So it's very traditional to talk about phases of matter in equilibrium. All these phases would exist in equilibrium. But the question is, can we go beyond that and talk about phases out of equilibrium? Now, once we talk about out of equilibrium, there is a question of, to what extent does the idea of phase of matter carry over? You know, is it meaningful to talk about that? Because non-equilibrium phenomena are so broad and varied, and maybe we expect them to be very different and not to have the same concept of phase of matter in a sharp sense. I'm not going to try to be completely general, but in my talk today, I'm going to talk basically a minimal generalization of equilibrium, which will indeed, as we will see, have a very sharp, well-defined notion of phase of matter that is the natural generalization of phase of matter in equilibrium. And so the scenario I want to discuss is first of all, if we have a system in equilibrium, what does that mean? It just means the system is exchanging heat with a heat bath, then the system will be in thermal equilibrium. So what if I just take this system and I remove the heat bath? The system is just evolving on its own. It's not coupled to anything. It just evolves on its own. A quantum system on its own that's isolated should just evolve out of a Schrodinger equation. So it's unitary time evolution. So that's the scenario I want to discuss, isolated quantum systems. So as we will see, there are many interesting theoretical phenomena that can occur in isolated quantum systems, but it's also motivated by experimental advances, because experimentalists get better and better at taking some quantum system and decoupling it from its environment, so reducing noise and reducing decoherence, for example. And so there are different platforms, and so these are platforms where one can actually hope to see the physics of isolated quantum systems, whatever that is, which I will explain what it is. But one thing, before I get to that, there's one thing that we can also do, because I said that, before I talk about that, I have to explain why I put this non-equilibrium question mark here. So if I had the system coupled to a heat bath, then it was in thermal equilibrium, we know that. But if I take the system and remove the heat bath, is it now non-equilibrium? Well, it depends. In fact, what often happens is that if you take some isolated quantum system evolving unitarily as given, but then you evolve it in time, what can often happen at late times is that the system actually looks like a thermal state, like a Gibbs state, like this state, for example, at least when you measure local observables. If the system evolves unitarily, a pure state cannot actually evolve into a mixed state. Unitary evolution preserves purity of a state. But what can happen is that at late times, the state of a system will actually look like a thermal state if you measure it in terms of local observables. So that's what we call thermalization. And so you can think of it as a system kind of serving as a heat buff for itself, or subsystems of a system serve as heat buff for each other, or something like that. And this actually is what believed to be the generic behavior. If you have some sufficiently generic, non-integrable quantum many-body system, it's generally believed that it will thermalize, and so that this will happen. But from the point of view of new, interesting, non-equilibrium phases of matter, that's obviously not what we want, because if the state of a system at late times is just a thermal state, thermal equilibrium state, then we'll see the same phases that we already knew before. So we have to ask, in what circumstances could this thermalization fail to occur? That will be the interesting case from the point of view of non-equilibrium phases of matter. And so when does thermalization fail? Well, if a system is integrable, generally it does not thermalize. However, that's very fine-tuned, so it's not so interesting from my point of view. But another case where thermalization fails, which is very interesting, is this thing called many-body localization. So basically, you might have heard about this, if you have strong disorder in your systems, strong static disorder, then this can actually inhibit thermalization. And so this does not occur. Instead, you have a system more about what does occur instead later, but many-body localization is kind of the opposite of thermalization, if you like. And this occurs generically as long as you have strong disorder in your system. So that's one circumstance we can look for new phases.
Dominic?
Yes?
To what extent has thermalization been verified?
I mean, it can only be verified numerically, I guess.
Yeah, to what extent numerically?
I mean, to the extent that you can simulate however big system you can do in numerics, like 20 or 30 or something, and then you'll see that at late times the system appears as though it's...
Do people trace all the rest of the system and look at the reduced place matrix, or do people just calculate the expectation value of some operators?
I mean, I think you can do both. It's also very closely related to the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which is another thing that people do. Like you take the Hamiltonian, you just compute its eigenstates, or again, it's in a finite system, and then you check that the eigenstates have thermal, the expectations of local observables are thermal. So that's something that people have checked numerically. Okay. So now, now that I'm talking about isolated quantum systems, we actually do something a bit more general. I can have a system that evolves, again, unitarily under the Schrodinger equation, but with a Hamiltonian that is time-dependent. I will go beyond this later, but for example, you could say that a Hamiltonian is time-periodic. So there's some period capital T, such that Hamiltonian T plus capital T is the same as Hamiltonian of T. So that is periodic driving. You shine some light on your system or some... radio waves or however you want to do it, or just, you know, tune the parameters by hand so that they vary time periodically in this way. And we also call, some people call also that Floquet systems if it's periodic like this. So what happens then? Again, we believe that the generic scenario is thermalization, but thermalization means something a little bit different for periodically driven systems because there's no conservation of energy. And if you have time-dependent Hamiltonian, energy is not conserved, you can think of this thermal canonical ensemble state e to the minus beta h as the state that maximizes entropy subject to the constraint of fixed energy. I mean, that's how you can compute it. Here you don't have conservation of energy, so the system will maximize its entropy with no constraint. And what is the state that maximizes entropy with no constraint? It's basically the infinite temperature state. It's the state where the density matrix is just the identity, so it's equal weight. Equal probability being in every state in the Hilbert space, basically. Again, this is only in terms of local observables. And we can also call that heating because you kind of imagine you have some for example, some low energy state, but then because energy is not conserved, it will absorb energy, and then eventually it will reach the infinite temperature state. Of course, there are some systems which have negative temperature, which is actually hotter than infinite temperature. So in that case, the system will cool to the infinite temperature state. The system, it is always the infinite temperature state one that maximizes the entropy. So that's what the system goes to. And so again, we want to ask, so for phases of matter, this is not very interesting. Again, this state is totally featureless. there's not much to see there. So again, we want to ask, how do we suppress this behavior? So there's different ways to do that. Again, integrable systems, but I don't want to talk about that because it's fine-tuned. You can also have many-body localization in periodically driven systems. So that, again, will suppress this firmalization behavior. And then there's one more, Floquet pre-firmalization, which I will come back to. But Floquet pre-firmalization is basically where you have the system heats eventually, but like at some very long time scale. And in the intermediate time regime, you can have interesting dynamics going on. So that's, you have intermediate time dynamics and very late time heating. So that's another thing that you can have. So, and then the nice thing about Floquet systems, so periodically driven systems, is that they can have fundamentally new phases that could not occur if you did not have periodic driving. And so why is that? I mean, there are various ways to think about it, but my favorite way is just in terms of symmetries. As I mentioned before, symmetries is a very important aspect of understanding phases of matter. And periodically driven systems actually have a new kind of symmetry. They have this discrete time translation symmetry. So, I mean, by definition, I said that the Hamiltonian is time periodic, but you can think of that as a symmetry because you translate in time by period capital T, and the Hamiltonian is the same. So it's a discrete time translation symmetry. So it's a very novel kind of symmetry in the sense that usually a symmetry would just be some operator that commutes with a Hamiltonian. I mean, this is not that. This is comparing the Hamiltonian at two different times, but we can still think of it as a symmetry, just a different, implemented in a different way than the conventional symmetries. And in particular, it can still determine phases of matter. Oops. If you have a new symmetry, it can lead to new phases of matter. And what kind of new phases of matter can you have? As I said before, you can have topological phases, so you can have spontaneous symmetry breaking phases. I will say more about topological phases later, but let me just focus on spontaneous symmetry breaking phases. You can have phases of matter where the order parameter or the characteristic of a phase is the fact that the discrete time translation symmetry is spontaneously broken. So that's what people call the discrete time crystal. It's a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase for the discrete time translation symmetry. So the signature of that is basically you drive in the system with period T, as I said, but then the system responds in a different way. It responds, for example, with period 2t, so it's a, we could call that a subharmonic response because it's half the base, half the driving frequency. So you drive it at period 2t, it responds at period 2t, and that's something that holds, you know, this is not just some transient behavior, this holds in terms of some steady state at late times. So there's some transient, this is some observable as a function of time, some transient behavior, then it relaxes into a steady state, but even in that steady state, you still see this subharmonic response. So this is spontaneous symmetry breaking phenomenon. And what I want to emphasize is that this is not just an accident, it's actually a phase. You can add generic perturbations to the Hamiltonian that describes this observation, and the signal will be robust. So here in this last paper, for example, they drew a phase diagram as a function of two different parameters. You know, there's some finite window of, it's some phase, it's not just some point. And if you add more parameters, again, it will be robust. So there will be some, you know, phase will have some non-trivial volume in parameter space. So this stable subharmonic response is basically what I would call spontaneous symmetry breaking of discrete time translation symmetry, which is discrete time crystal.
So Dominic, in this example, in the long time limit, does this go to infinite temperature again?
Well, in this model, no, because this model we put disorder in, so it's many-body localized. Many-body localization, it can, in principle, not heat even at infinite times.
Question?
Yeah.
So in equilibrium phases, symmetry broken phase is stable. The way we can understand it is, suppose we go to the symmetry broken state and we want to restore the symmetry, we need to proliferate the defects. But the defects cause some free energy or energy. Here in this time translation symmetry broken state, is there any analogous intuitive picture to understand the robustness of the phase?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's difficult to talk about free energy in the context of many-body localization because it's not really an equilibrium. Free energy is an equilibrium quantity. There is another kind of time crystal, which is what I call pre-firmal time crystal, where it is in equilibrium in a certain sense. And then in that case, you could talk about it as you describe. with multiparametric localization, you can't really describe it that way, but well, I'm not sure what the right way to say it is. I mean, yeah, well, okay, let me not try to answer that. With multiparametric localization, it's difficult to use that particular language, but it is stable for reasons. Okay, so that's, yeah, that's all I wanted to say about discrete time crystal. Because that story is old, a bit old now, a few years old, and I wanted to tell you about something new. And so I want to take this idea, but take it further. And so how do I take it further? Well, I mentioned that the reason why we have this new phase of matter, new non-equilibrium phase of matter, is because we have a new symmetry, the discrete time transition symmetry. So suppose I can drive the system in a way that realizes a different symmetry or a larger symmetry group. And so suppose, for example, I want to have not just a time transition symmetry is generated just by one operator, the time step operator. But suppose I want to have a symmetry group that's generated by two independent symmetry operators. So if, for example, I had as universe which had two time directions, and I could time translate in two different independent time directions, and then maybe I could have two time translation symmetries, two independent time translation symmetries. Okay, but that's obviously not, I mean, there's some crazy papers in Fries of D, but that's not what I want to talk about today. It turns out that there's a way to simulate two independent time directions, even though physically our universe only has a single time. So that's what I want to discuss. And so the way we do it is basically quasi-periodic driving. So that's the next part of my talk now. And so what is quasi-periodic driving? It's basically you take two frequencies which are independent, or two frequencies, so that their ratio is irrational number, and then you superpose the two frequencies. So you're driving the system, but in a different way, with like superposing these two independent frequencies, irrationally related. It doesn't have to be just two. You can take m frequencies. You can drive a system at m different frequencies simultaneously. We just require that their frequencies should be rationally independent. So if we define this frequency vector, omega 1 to omega m, then we require that n not omega is non-zero for any integer vector n. So that's what the definition of rationally independent. And just to be more concrete, we can consider a simple case m equals 2. As I mentioned, we have two different frequencies and their ratio is an irrational number. So that's sufficient in the m equals 2 case to imply this rational independence condition. And just to be a bit more precise, we can say that a function is quasi-periodic with some frequency vector omega if it can be written in the following form. So f of t is a function of a single time, but it can be written in a form in this form where you have some f of theta, which is a function of m different phase angles, theta 1 and theta m, theta 1 to theta m. It's 2 pi periodic in each argument and piecewise continuous. Anyway, the point is there's a function of m variables, but then the actual function f of t is realized by just taking the frequency vector and multiplying by t. So you sweep out a particular path in terms of these phase angles. So that's the definition of quasi-periodic mathematically. I mean, let me just show you some pictures which might clarify things. So basically the situation is that we have a periodic function, this function f of theta. It's periodic, but in higher dimensions. So for example, in two dimensions. So here we have some periodic function in two dimensions. But then we're slicing through this space at some irrational angle. So we have a function, in order to find a function of a single time variable, we go along this red line. So as a function of time, we go up to some distance along the red line, and then we take whatever value of a two-dimensional function is at that point, and that defines a one-dimensional function now, which is shown here in terms of color, so here is the plot. And so that one-dimensional function is quasi-periodic. It's defined in terms of its two-dimensional periodic function, but the one-dimensional function doesn't have any exact periodicity, so it's quasi-periodic. And then another way to say that, we can take just a single unit cell of this two-dimensional space and then mod out by translation, so it gives you the torus. And then basically we're sweeping out a path in that torus at some irrational, again, at some irrational angle. So what that means is that this path densely fills the torus. Instead of, if the angle was not irrational, if it was some rational angle, then basically after some finite length, a path would close on in on itself and go back to the same value. But for quasi-periodic drives where this angle is irrational, basically the path never comes back to itself. Instead, the path actually fills the torus densely. And there's arbitrary close recurrences because you can always get, if you wait long enough, you always get arbitrarily close back to the same point, but you never get back exactly to the same point. So it's close recurrences, but not exact recurrences. Right. So that's the setup of quasi-periodic driving, and now we're going to talk about interesting phases of matter that can occur in that context. A classic paper along these lines was this paper. They talked about band structure, like you have free fermion systems, they have band structure invariants. So you should store topological insulators, for example. But here, they discussed band structure invariants in the context of quasi-periodic driving, and they showed that you can realize like two-dimensional band structure invariants, for example, in just a single spin. It's like you get extra dimensions somehow. So that's interesting. It's a non-interacting system, so I wanted to extend to interacting systems and see what kind of interacting phases of matter can you occur. But then if you're going to answer that, you first have to address the question of heating, because as I said, a generic-driven interacting system is expected to heat up, and then you certainly, if it heats to an infinite temperature state, you don't see anything interesting. So how can we suppress heating? That's in order to describe new phases of matter in interacting systems, I have to tell you how to suppress heating. So that's what I want to talk to you about for a while. So first, I want to remind you, how do we suppress heating in a periodically driven system? And then I will move on to quasi-periodically driven systems, and you see how it's different. So I will do this always. All of these arguments will be a very intuitive hand-waving level, but eventually it will be turned into a rigorous theorem. For the moment, I'm just giving you the intuitive argument. So I'm going, as I said, back to periodic-driven systems now. What I'm going to do, I'm going to imagine I have some Hamiltonian. It's some static piece plus some perturbation. I'm going to treat that perturbation I'm going to treat the V of t as a perturbation, for example, in time-independent perturbation theory. And just roughly, what does adding a driving perturbation to a static Hamiltonian do perturbatively? It induces transitions between energy levels of a static Hamiltonian. So we have this Hamiltonian H bar, it has some energy levels, and then because you're driving the system, it can absorb energy and induce transitions. So if your system is originally in some eigenstate, it can absorb energy and then jump to a higher eigenstate. And it would absorb energy omega. Omega is the driving frequency, so you always absorb energy in quanta of omega. You're basically absorbing a photon, if you want to put it that way. You can also absorb energy at 2 omega, because generally there will also be frequencies 2 omega present in the drive. These are the harmonics of the original driving frequency. Of course, you can also emit a photon and lose energy. This is like some stimulated emission process, if you want to put it that way. The point is these processes are bad because these processes lead to heating because they don't conserve energy. So how do we avoid that? And we need to use this idea of locality. I assume that this Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms, and so is the V of t. So it means that any absorption or emission process has to happen locally, and that places constraints on the rate at which such processes can occur. So any absorption process, think of it as absorbing some photon or whatever, but it has to happen in the vicinity of some point x, because everything is local. And what constraint does that impose? Well, we have to compare two different things. We have to compare the what are the possible energies which you can absorb and emit from a drive in terms of like what photon energies could you absorb or emit. And for a periodic driving, this is just integer multiples of a driving frequency. And then you have to compare this to something, to the local spectrum of a Hamiltonian. Near this point x, the Hamiltonian has some kind of local spectrum, which you can think of as basically the energies at which if you imagine like Fermi's golden rule, for example, it has some matrix elements of some local observable in the transition rate. And so this local spectrum is basically the possible energies at which that matrix element would be appreciable. And so it has some finite extent. Generally, the width of the local spectrum is on the order of J, which is the local coupling strength of a Hamiltonian. And generally, for a generic system, the local spectrum is continuous, except for the fact that it has this finite extent. So then, if there's a matching between a photon energy and a, an energy which a system is capable of absorbing, which is this local spectrum, then an absorption process will take place. So given that we want to avoid that, how do we avoid it? Well, there's two ways. One of them is if you have strong disorder, so many-body localized. For many-body localized system, actually, the local spectrum is discrete. So generically, you'll have a mismatch between the possible energies the system can absorb and the photon energies. So then absorption processes don't take place because there's a mismatch between these energies. And then the other way is if you drive a system at very high frequencies, so the frequency is much larger than the local coupling strength of a Hamiltonian. Then, as I said, because of the local bandwidth, you can think of this as the local bandwidth is of the order of j. If omega is much greater than j, then you'll see that all possible photon energies are greater than the local bandwidth. And so then the system also is incapable of absorbing energy because the local bandwidth is too small. So in summary, how do you avoid heating in a periodically driven system? Either by high frequency driving, and it turns out that the rate, the time at which heating takes place, the time scale scales exponentially in the frequency. Before I made it sound like that if omega was greater than j, that there was no process that could occur. But actually, there are kind of more non-local things that can happen, but they're very strongly suppressed. So that's the source of this exponential scaling. So if omega is much greater than j, so very high frequencies, and the heating time is incredibly long. And so the rigorous proof of that, I mean, obviously I gave you some very hand-waving arguments, but the rigorous proof of that has been completed in these papers. And then the other option is you have strong disorder, so many-body localization. And then in that case, we believe the heating time, as I mentioned before, we believe that the heating time can actually be infinite. I can't say that this has been rigorously proven. Rigorously proving anything in many-body localization is very hard, but at least there is some evidence for that. Yeah.
Can you make one size?
Yeah.
So if you have two different streams, it seems that this one is pretty dense. Then how can you do the mismatch?
You're talking about quasi-periodic driving now?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was what I was getting to. Yes, this picture. Right, so for quasi-periodically driven systems, the situation is different because in terms of what energies can you absorb from a drive, it's not just equally spaced, it's not just omega 2, omega 3, omega. Now you have two different frequencies, omega 1 and omega 2. Well, for example, in the case of two different frequencies, you have omega 1 and omega 2, so you can absorb energy in quanta of n1 omega 1 plus n2 omega 2, where n1 and n2 is n the integer. Or compactly, I can write it omega dot n, where omega is this frequency vector I defined, and n is some integer vector. So in fact, the set of all possible such delta e's is dense on the real line. So then it seems like you're in trouble, because no matter what you do over here, you disorder or high frequency, it looks like you always have a matching, and then it looks like the system is always going to absorb energy. So that seems pretty bad. But the story, so we have to be a bit more careful about our analysis now, and then we'll see how we avoid this problem. So let me just go back to this this picture. So I have a static Hamiltonian plus the time-dependent perturbation. Now it's going to be quasi-periodic, so that means V of t is V omega t for some function V of theta. That was my definition of quasi-periodic driving. And then V of theta is periodic, so it's periodic in theta 1, periodic in theta 2, so it lives on the torus. So now I can take this V of theta and I can expand it in a Fourier series. Any function over torus can be expanded on a Fourier series. And then so I sum over n. Because of my normalization of a torus, which is, I take it to be 2 pi in each direction, I sum over integer vectors n in the Fourier series. And then I can substitute into this equation. So I get an expression for V of t like this. And then, so if you look at this term, V of n e to the I n dot omega t, because it's oscillating with frequency n dot omega, it's going to induce transitions between energy levels that differ in energy by n dot omega. So that's kind of what I said. So we can have transitions if delta E is n dot omega for any integer vector n. But here's a thing. Let's suppose that we take v of theta to be a smooth function. So if a driving is a smooth function of time, then we can take v of theta to be a smooth function of theta. And then we know that for smooth functions, their Fourier transforms decay very fast. So if v of theta is smooth, then the Fourier coefficients decay exponentially in n. So then, so if v of n is like exponentially small in n, it means that the rate of the transitions it induces also is exponentially suppressed by n. So it tells you that you should only really worry about the transitions of small n, because the transitions of large n are very strongly suppressed by this exponential factor. So in terms of this picture, rather than drawing it like this, maybe I should really draw it like this, where I weight each delta E is n dot omega. I weight it by this exponential factor. Then it looks more like this. So in principle, it's still dense, but there are some particular lines which are brighter. Like, for example, if I have two frequencies, this could be omega 1 and omega 2. And then I also have like the small harmonics of n1 omega 1 plus n2 omega 2, where n1 and n2 are small. So that's some of these lines that you can see which are fainter. But the important thing is, because we have this exponential decay, not only does it decay, do the lines decay up here, they also decay near zero. That's the important thing. Because if you want to get near zero by n1 omega 1 plus n2 omega 2, n1 and n2 have to be really big. So if it's exponentially suppressed there. So the lines near zero are very strongly suppressed. And so that means indeed, if you now have high frequency, so the J is kind of some narrow band around zero compared to the frequencies, then you expect very slow heating. It's also interesting to talk about what happens if you have disorder and how does that change things, but that's a question for future work. In this paper, we focused on this high frequency case. And so we can quantify how fast do we expect the system to heat, but we need to know, like, given that the statement is that what saves us is the fact that n dot omega has to be, if you want it to be small, then n has to be really big. We want to quantify that exactly, how that works. So that's kind of a math problem, really. People call it Diophantine approximation sometimes. It's kind of saying, or at least in the case of two frequencies, it's saying, like, how well can you approximate an irrational number by some rational approximation? Let me just to set it up, let's take this frequency vector, and I'm going to take out the magnitude. And so alpha is now some vector of order 1, and omega is the frequency magnitude, the overall frequency scale, if you'd like. And then we have this theorem, which is that almost all n-dimensional vectors alpha satisfy the following condition. So alpha dot n is greater than or equal to c times n to some power, and the constant c depends on alpha. So this is indeed telling you that if you want alpha dot n to be small, then n needs to be really big in an appropriate way. And it tells you this, how that scales with n. And so almost all n-dimensional vectors alpha satisfy that. So here I use almost all in the mathematical sense. I mean that all vectors except for a set of measure 0 satisfy this condition. So of course, for example, if you have omega 1 and omega 2 and their ratio is rational number, then certainly this is not satisfied, because actually in that case this could be 0 even for some finite n. But rational numbers are a set of measure 0 in the irrational. Rational numbers are a set of measure 0 in the reals. And so generally, for everything except a set of measure 0, we have this property. And so if you now compare this with this argument I gave before, we can estimate how big the heating time is, given that it's these kinds of processes for large n that contribute to heating at high frequencies. And so this is the estimate you get. So it's scaled, heating time scales. Again, you want frequency to be large, so omega is much greater than j. And then it scales as a stretched exponential in that ratio. In the Fourier case, periodically driven case, it was just exponential. Here it's stretched exponential. But C star can still be very big if you make omega dot j big enough.
Sorry, epsilon is just some number, constant number, or?
Yeah. I could lie to you and tell you epsilon equals zero, because actually this equation holds for any epsilon. It's just any epsilon greater than zero, it's just a C kind of grows if you make epsilon too small. So you could set epsilon to any value as long as it's greater than zero, it's just the constant changes. So you could basically, you know, if you're not being very careful, you could just say epsilon equals zero. So then it would be just like 1 over m here. So that's the heating time. So there's some very long preheating regime, which we will look for phases of matter in. I give you hand-waving arguments, but you know, this is what we did. One of the things we did in the paper, we actually turned this into a theorem, very rigorously, you know, at the level of mathematical physics, proof that indeed T star is bounded by this estimate. So we do have a very long heating time. And then there's another thing which we proved also, which is actually very important. So given that we have this very long heating time, we can ask about how do you describe the dynamics of a system before heating takes place in the preheating regime. So that's when T is less than the heating time. So in that regime, what we prove is the dynamics is well approximated by the following equation. U of T is just the time evolution operator from 0 to T. And then it can be expressed in this form, where D is a quasi-local static Hamiltonian, and P of T is a local energy that's quasi-periodic in time. So what this tells you is that you can make a rotating frame transformation, quasi-periodic rotating frame transformation, and in that rotating frame, the evolution is just governed by a static Hamiltonian D. And it's a local, quasi-local static Hamiltonian D. So that means that given that we understand the dynamics of static Hamiltonians, then we can understand the dynamics of this quasi-periodic driven problem. But you have to remember that you know the static Hamiltonian is only in the rotating frame. So in addition to the dynamics of a static Hamiltonian, you will have to, in terms of what we measure, you have to undo the rotating frame transformation. So it will take basically this dynamics of static Hamiltonian and then superimpose a quasi-periodic oscillation on top of that. Let me show you a picture to show you. So let's suppose that the Hamiltonian D is ergodic. So that means that the Hamiltonian D has this thermalizing property that I mentioned. So at late times, the dynamics of D basically becomes a thermal state. The dynamics of D leads to a thermal state in terms of local observables. So basically what happens, we have in terms of time, the function of time, we look at some local observable. So first there's some transient regime, but then we get to this plateau. And what happens at this plateau is that the system, in the rotating frame where you have this Hamiltonian D, in the rotating frame, the system has gone to a thermal state of D, which is time independent. And then the reason why we still have these oscillations, which as you can see from this picture are basically quasi-periodic oscillations, is because of this rotating frame transformation. So you have to undo the rotating frame transformation. So you get the thermal state of D, but then you superimpose these oscillations on top. And then at very late times, you know, this is the heating time, which I estimated before. That's the time at which this approximation breaks down. So then, in that case, the system heats up and becomes totally featureless at late times. But anyway, this plateau is the where I want to talk about interesting phases of matter. So it's approximately a steady state, metastable, I guess, because it's eventually decays, but it lasts for a very, very long time. So it's an almost steady state. This is a log scale, remember. So it lasts for a very long time. And there can be interesting phases that occur in that steady state.
Sorry, go ahead. So I assume this is calculated from some finite system size?
This is not calculated from anything. This is schematic. probably should have mentioned that. But we haven't done any numerics. I mean, we have this rigorous theorem, so, but in terms of numerics, we haven't done anything yet.
I see.
Yeah.
So PET is local
as a local unit, right? Yeah. So how what's the size of the typical transformation? It depends on the parameter omega of the J, but generally when I think kind of the length scale is basically on the order of the inverse J over omega. So the higher frequency is the more local the unitary is.
My question is, will size grow with time?
Sorry?
Will the size grow with time?
No, it's as I said, it's quasi-periodic. So quasi-periodic basically, if it's quasi-periodic, it cannot grow with time because you know it has these arbitrary close recurrences. So. Yeah, so there's another thing we can talk about as well, which is suppose that I guess we're getting a bit technical here, but You can consider also the case where this effective static Hamiltonian is many-body localized instead of ergodic, and then that also leads to some interesting phenomenology, because you get, you know, if the effective static Hamiltonian is many-localized, then you have some phenomena of many-body localization in the even in the rotating frame, but it's a new kind of many-body localization, because the definition of MBL, many-body localization in a static system, is you have some complete set of local integrals of motion called the Elbits. So the local integrals of motion by definition commute with the Hamiltonian. And then, so that's just implementing kind of the local memory, the system remembers for its initial state forever. And then we can talk about MBL in a periodically driven system. So again, you have a complete set of local integrals of motion, but what does local integral of motion mean in this case? It doesn't mean that the tau iz's commute with the time-dependent Hamiltonian at all times. That would be too strong of a condition. It just means that the so-called local integral of motion commute with uf, which is the time evolution operator from 0 to t, the driving period. So this is kind of a discrete time evolution operator. Tau iz commutes with that. But now we have what we've shown is that we can also have, at least in some metastable sense, quasi-periodically driven many-body localization. But then what does that even mean? Normally we define MBL by these properties, but what should tau iz commute with now? There's no analog of h, there's no analog of uf in a quasi-periodically driven system. There's no single time evolution, discrete time step. Well, it turns out the definition is the following. The definition of quasi-periodically driven MBL is that you take some operator, you have this set of operators tau iz, but we can't call them integrals of motion anymore, but they have a following property that you take tau iz and you conjugate it by the time evolution operator, so you evolve it in time. That time evolution is quasi-periodic in time. It's, yeah, some technical point, it's the reverse Heisenberg evolution because it's ut, u dagger rather than u dagger u, which would be the usual Heisenberg. Anyway, so this turns out to be the definition of quasi-periodically driven MBL. Certainly, this is a very strong constraint because, for example, if you had some generic ergodic system, you'd expect any operator to spread diffusively or ballistically, whereas quasi-periodicity, because they have these recurrences, basically means the operator approximately comes back to itself many times, so it doesn't actually spread out at all. That's a very non-trivial constraint, but so it's kind of, in some sense, it's still the opposite of formalization, but that's the definition. Anyway, let me skip past that, because I want to talk about the interesting phases of matter, which is kind of the whole point. And so phase number one is discrete time quasi-crystal. So discrete time quasi-crystal is going to be kind of a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase, but it's going to be a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase in this extended space. So remember what I told you, that these quasi-periodic systems can be obtained by taking a cut through a periodic space in higher dimensions. You can define spontaneous symmetry breaking in this higher dimensional space, but it will still have non-trivial consequences for a single time which we observe, even though there isn't really a symmetry in the single time, but it will still be a distinct phase, like you have distinct phases that are just have some sharp difference between them. So we can still call it kind of a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase. Let me draw some pictures to make this clearer. So we have some system and we're driving it quasi-periodically. So as always, that means that we're taking a cut through a periodic space in higher dimensions. So here we have some periodicity in some two-dimensional space and we take a cut through it. And so here we can show what that function looks like as a function of a single time. You know, there's a bunch of peaks, but they're not totally periodic, they're quasi-periodic. So that's the way we're driving the system, this profile of drive. But now we can talk about the response of the system. So we're driving the system in some way, but it responds in a different way. And it responds in a way that actually corresponds to changing the periodicity in the higher dimensional space, in the extended space. So here we have a higher dimensional space, but you see it doesn't have the same periodicity as the this space. Here you translate by one over here, from here to here. It's periodic, but here it's not periodic. We've changed the periodicity. So it's spontaneously symmetry breaking, but quote unquote time translation symmetries, but which are the translation symmetries in this extended space. So these are being spontaneously broken. And so you could ask, does this actually have any, you know, does this make sense in terms of all we actually observe is a single time? So, you know, is that actually a meaningful statement? Well, it is a meaningful statement, it turns out. I mean, you can kind of see here that somehow these trends are different, but that's not very precise. To be more precise, what we're going to do is we're going to take the Fourier transform of these. So we take the Fourier transform, we have this time dependence, we take its Fourier transform, and then we'll see that there is a difference. So basically, so the red here is the Fourier transform of the driving profile, and then the blue is the Fourier transform of the response. So they both have discrete peaks. I mean, that's one of the properties of quasi-periodic driving, that they have you know, discrete peaks in the Fourier transform. In the infinite time limit, they're delta function peaks. But the peaks occur at different locations. This is the important thing. The driving has peaks at n, that we already saw this quantity before, n dot omega, where we have integer vectors n, and omega is a frequency vector. The response has peaks at alpha dot omega, where alpha is a reciprocal lattice vector of the new lattice. So we have this new lattice in the, so going back here, we have this new lattice in the extended space, and then we can take the reciprocal lattice of that. And so that gives you different reciprocal lattice vectors. And the peaks of a response occur at alpha dot omega, where alpha is any reciprocal lattice vector for the new lattice. And the important thing is that this gives you new peaks that were not there in the original drive. So in the original drive, we had frequency, for example, you could think about this one as omega 1 and this one is omega 2. And then we have some other peaks, which are the harmonics of that. So n1 omega 1 plus n2 omega 2. So that's this formula. But the response has peaks at totally different locations, which are correspond to these new reciprocal lattice vectors. So this really is a sharply distinct thing, because the existence or non-existence of these new peaks is the signature of a phase. So you can have a trivial phase which doesn't have the new peaks, and a non-trivial phase which does have these new peaks. And I mean, they're sharply distinct regimes. They can only be connected by a phase transition.
And that omega is dense.
It's dense, yeah, but you have to remember also that these peaks are weighted by this, because the drive is smooth, so the peaks are weighted by this exponential decaying factor. So in theory, like, there's a peak everywhere on here, but most of them are really small. And in fact, if you look at like how, suppose that you have this new peak, and suppose that there was a red peak here, like it would actually have to be like, the closer you try to make this red peak to the blue peak, the smaller it would have to be. So it actually kind of, if you tried to make the red peak sit on top of the blue peak, it would actually have amplitude zero.
Is it sharply defined?
It is sharply, as long as the decay is at all, I think it is sharply defined, because the, yes, it's dense, but.
So it's more quantitative than.
It is quantitative. I mean, so we have this peak. So this is the new peak, right? Okay, and then we have some, maybe I should use a different color. And then we have the old peaks, right? That is the peaks of the original drive.
The primary.
Yeah. So right, of the drive, yeah, this would be the ones in red on this picture, the you know, what you put in. And so, in principle, there's arbitrary many peaks, but they're getting smaller and smaller as they get close to here. You could call it like a soft gap or something. So the existence of this kind of structure where you know, the peaks go to zero as you get close to the new one. I mean, that does allow you to sharply distinct the existence of this one, which is not zero, from these ones which go to zero as you go close. Does that make sense?
Oh, you mean the weight at the new frequency goes to
zero? Yeah, at the new frequency, the weight of the original drive goes to zero. That's
goes
right.
To zero, it's not finite.
Yeah.
And if it's in the quote-unquote trivial phase, we expect the blue peaks to be just at the red peaks?
That's right, yeah, that would be the trivial phase. So what's the question?
So if in the real space, if I understand this, the order on the one-dimensional line as some long segment, short segment, long segment, short segment, this pattern. So the
kind of. I mean, it's not exactly like this. You see that this is not exactly just short long. It's a little more complicated than that. But
so does that preserve the pattern or not?
Does what preserve a pattern?
The symmetry breaking. What?
I mean, it's if you look at this, it's kind of like you see that there's some you have these red lines, right?
Yeah.
And then you have these blue fins, or I don't. So I mean, these occur basically at the same locations, which means the same times. But here, as you go across this peak. You just go, you know, go from zero to some large value and then back to zero. But here, as you go across one of these peaks, it goes from zero to one, for example. So in that sense, I mean, I don't think that this is a sharp universal signature, but at least in this model, you see that the stuff happens kind of somewhat suddenly, and it's at the same locations here and here. But the suddenness here actually is like a step. It takes you from zero to one, whereas here it's just a peak, it goes from zero to zero. If that makes sense.
So is it can we view this as being smoothly connected to the time crystal in the periodic driven system? Given that I can change the angle, say, you know, if I scan vertically, that's the time crystal in the first example that you mentioned. The response has omega over 2.
Well, you have to be careful because you want the angle of the line to be irrational. You can move it around a little bit because, like, even if it's irrational, but it's rational with some very big denominator, maybe you don't care too much about that. But if you really make it like go to horizontally, then it's like rational with a very low denominator, and that seems pretty bad. So I don't think that it would be smoothly connected in that sense.
I can choose any angle.
Yeah, but the heating time depends on that, right? You have this estimate for heating time. This constant depends on the choice of the frequency vector. And this constant for rational frequency vectors is kind of infinite.
So maybe in the disordered system, they may be smoothly connected.
Well, I think in disordered system, you also have a dependence on the frequency vector in a similar way. Because you still have to avoid this, you still have to make sure there's always this mismatch between the. I think that also depends very sensitively on the rational independence of frequency vector.
For natural choice of the frequency, this would make.
Well, it's true. I mean, we know that periodic driving also has slow heating. I mean, this result also holds. All these results hold also for the case m equals 1. Which is periodic driving. So you also have slow heating with periodic driving, but the nature of a resulting Hamiltonian, like the resulting D, is rather different if you try to adjust the frequency. Because I didn't mention this, but it turns out the Hamiltonian D actually has an emergent symmetry group, and so the emergent symmetry group is different between the quasi-periodic case and the periodic case. So in that sense, it seems like it's qualitatively different between the two cases and maybe cannot be deformed.
So just to be clear, you're saying MBL with quasi-periodic driving and without any constraints on the frequency may not be, disorder with quasi-periodic driving, no constraint on frequency, may not necessarily be localized?
Yeah, well, even if you put a constraint on the frequency, even if you say the frequency is rationally independent, I don't think it's not known that you can get MBL in that case. Well, except for in this high frequency limit. In the high frequency limit, then we just reduce to a static Hamiltonian. So then in that case, you can have MBL. But I think the question was, I don't know if this was a question, but going beyond the high frequency limit, I mean, and going beyond this finite time scope T star, can you still have many good localization? And that's not clear for quasi-periodic driving or. No, I kind of forgot what the original question was, but okay. All right, so that's for discrete time quasicrystal. So I mean, this is a stable response. You know, I should emphasize that. You can add perturbations to the Hamiltonian. This is not some fine-tuned fin. You add perturbations to Hamiltonian. You know, maybe it will change the weights of a pixel a little bit. That's not the universal feature, but the locations and the peaks, and in particular the fact that you have these new peaks at these specified locations, that doesn't depend on perturbations. So, yeah.
So, and what's the parameter that you tune can give you these two phases? Like, is it the amplitude of the driving or?
You could tune some field in the Hamiltonian. I think if you have some, I mean, I didn't really give you the model, but I think if the model basically involves some Ising couplings in the Hamiltonian, if you had a very strong transverse field, I think it will kind of push you out of the symmetry breaking phase.
So that's the parameter you tune to give with these two different.
Yeah, I mean, there are many different parameters you could imagine tuning. That's one example. Okay. So yeah, it's stable with respect to perturbation. So I think that qualifies it as a phase of matter. And I guess you could say it's a spontaneous symmetry breaking phase, although it's spontaneously breaking a symmetry that wasn't really present, I mean, except in this extended space. But apart from that, it has all the phenomenology of spontaneously breaking, order parameters, rigidity, all that kind of thing.
So related question is that so in the frequency space, you have you have to have some broadening by one over t star.
Yes.
So there's some uncertainty in frequency.
Yes.
And then the new frequency, the original frequency, they have some weight within.
That's right. So for finite T star, it's not 100% a sharp distinction because of, you know, these pieces get broadened and so you don't have these sharp distinctions anymore. But I mean, T star could be very long. So then.
So your statement is in the limit that T star is infinite, this is sharply.
Yeah. Defined. Yeah, and for T star large, it's almost sharply defined. I mean, like your phases, instead of two sharp phases, maybe it becomes some crossover, but like some very narrow crossover, for example.
But why can't you push T star to infinity with this order? Like, what's your reservation that it might fail in that case?
Well, what's your reason why you think it would work?
Well, it seems to work for one frequency. Why is this that much different?
Right. It's kind of subtle. I might have to explain it to you later. I was thinking about this. As for many localization, you have this paper by Imbri, which is a proof of MBL is in one dimension. I looked at Imbri and I tried to explain it to quasi-periodic driving, and there was one step which broke down in a very particular way. Okay, but I might have to explain that later. I mean, maybe you can have a different argument that overcomes that, but I think it's a very non-trivial problem.
Sorry. In the case where there's no symmetry breaking of this extended symmetry, do the blue peaks have some monotonic relation in their height to the red peaks? Or?
I'm not sure what you mean
by that. You said that they'll lie on top of them, but will the taller red peaks correspond to taller blue peaks?
To an extent, maybe, but I think that will depend on the what on the specific model. That wouldn't be like a universal thing. Okay. Right. Are we done with this or? I did want to say one more thing about this. In terms of this idea of stability, I said that you can vary the parameters of a Hamiltonian, but can you vary the frequency vector? That's kind of actually a new thing that you couldn't even think about doing in the quasi-periodic case. I mean, vary the frequency vector in the sense that I change the ratios of the frequencies to each other. So I mean, as I said before, if a ratio, if frequencies are a rational ratio, that a rational ratio to each other, that would be bad from a point of view of heating. But if it's a ratio, if it is rational with a very large denominator, it kind of almost is irrational. Like it would, you have, it's very hard to tell, for instance, in a rational number with a very large ratio and a irrational number. At least maybe you can tell the difference at very long times. You can resolve the difference, but at short times you don't tell the difference. So in that sense, maybe you can vary the frequency vector continuously as long as you don't look to too late times. Anyway, if you do that, so if you do that, the phase is also stable. It's just that the peaks move around because the peaks depend on omega. So you vary omega, the peaks will move around. But these n's and these alphas are discrete fins. So these are the stable properties. So peaks move around. It's a function of omega, though. Okay. I think, wait, should I stop now or is there?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay. I have time to do a lightning discussion of quasi-periodic topological phases. So yeah, as I said, we can have, whenever we have new symmetries, you know, I want to think about these phases as being related to new symmetries, multiple time translation symmetries, even though that only makes sense in extended space. We have new symmetries, you can have new spontaneous symmetric phases, but you can also have new topological phases, or symmetry-protected topological phases. I'm going to go back to this MBL fin, and then you have these L-bits, but they evolve quasi-periodically, and then you can kind of do a topological classification of quasi-periodic evolution of L-bits. Okay, that's a very hard problem. Even in the Floquet case, it's a very hard problem, which people have only done some very partial results. But I can say something like more simple, which is you just, rather than looking for at all the L bits, you take a single eigenstate, a single simultaneous eigenstate, and then we know from anybody local system, because it's an eigenstate of simultaneous eigenstate of all these quasi-local operators, it basically looks like a gapped ground state. It's one of the properties of many-body localization that the eigenstates look like gap ground states. And now I can consider its evolution as a function of time. And this reverse Heisenberg evolution being quasi-periodic actually implies that the time evolution of psi is quasi-periodic. This is the time evolution of this eigenstate. And then because it's quasi-periodic, it really depends on, you can reformulate in terms of this m-dimensional torus now, in the usual way, because you're densely filling in the torus. So I want to give a topological classification of maps from the M torus into gapped ground states. So have, and well, I mean, for the case M equals one, which is periodic driving, it's kind of, you can draw this picture, like I can have loops of states that are not that are contractible, or I could have loops of states that are non-contractible. And these are topologically distinct, so these will describe different phases of a sort of periodically driven MBL system, depending on this winding number. And then you can do the same thing. There's some generalized notion of winding number for these states parameterized by the torus. It's kind of harder to draw. Anyway, what is the answer to that classification? That's something I can tell you. Let me skip over that. The classification of maps from a two torus into the space of gap ground states, maybe I put some internal symmetry G in, is in one-to-one correspondence with the classification of phases, of stationary phases. So these are the usual zero temperature topological phases with symmetry G times Z times Z. So basically in terms of a classification, you know, I mentioned these multiple time translation symmetries, even though they're not really symmetries, but the classification thinks they're symmetries because the classification of these maps parameterized by the torus is the same as the classification of SPT, symmetry protected or symmetry enriched phases with this enhanced symmetry. So basically it looks like you have this multiple time translation symmetry in terms of classification. So topological phases protected by two-dimensional time translation symmetry. Yes?
Is this correspondence working just for the group cohomology or does it work also for the other generalized?
No, it works for everything basically. Well, maybe not fractons. I don't know. Fractons are weird, but
let's say I take the cobalt as a
yeah, it works for that. It works also for symmetry-enriched topological phases. Okay, so that's the story. We can have topological phases protected by multiple time transition symmetries. Of course, I should tell you about observable signatures of subchains, but I don't really know what they are at the moment. I hope that we will be able to work that out. I've given my whole talk without mentioning any Hamiltonians, but I should mention the Hamiltonian. So I talked about this discrete time quasicrystal, and then let me just write for Hamiltonian that can realize that discrete time quasicrystal. It's very simple. You just have some spin chain, for example, or some system of spin one halves, and then I have a transverse field, sigma x, and it's modulated by some time quasiperiodic. The coefficient is time quasiperiodic, and then I have some Ising coupling as well, and then plus dot dot dot. Dot 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 could be anything, because as I said, these phases are stable to any perturbations. Anyway, as long as you choose the f of t correctly, then it turns out this gives you this discrete time quasicrystal phase. So this is not too complicated, and hopefully it's something that we can actually see in experiment. And yeah, let me stop there.
Can you remind me for the pre-thermal story, do you care what dimension you live in? Because for the MBL, sort of delegating higher dimension. For MBL, it's delegating higher dimension. What about the pre-thermal?
Well, MBL may not exist in higher dimensions.
Right. What about the pre-thermal one?
Well, the theorem we proved about slow heating and all that.
Right.
It's true in any dimension. But if you want to realize for the discrete time quasicrystal, there are constraints from like Mohmann-Wagner type stuff. Like, if you have short range interactions, you cannot realize the spontaneous energy breaking phase in one dimension. So you need to have either two dimensions or long range interactions.
So this type of Hamiltonian is special in the operator that couples to two frequency commute. But in general,
well, no, that's not so important. I mean, I could make this J also depend quasi periodically if I want.
So what you told
today
doesn't depend on the two
operator
coming in.
Yeah, that's right.
Any other question? If not, that's it.